The Pain Pod is produced by Bloodstream Media and is intended for informational and educational purposes only, and is made possible thanks to our sponsor, Trimo Pharmaceuticals. Visit resethastudy.com to learn more about their work.
Pain is a subjective experience that every patient feels a little differently.
Pain is unique to every individual. Every person is going to express pain, is going to cope with pain in a little bit of a different way.
Pain, it can be physical, mental, or emotional. If you were to go outside and ask every person you met if they had ever felt pain, you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who hasn't experienced it. You might even find some people who seemingly have the same type of pain. But if you dig deeper, just below the surface, you'd soon find that no two experiences are alike. Yes, pain is universal, but everyone's experience, perception, and even treatment of pain is different and extremely personal. In season 2, we heard stories from people who live with chronic pain, and as we found out, no two stories were the same. So in this season, we take a deeper look into the variances of the pain experience and attempt to understand how different cultures, societies, and even micro-societies around the U.S. experience and feel pain differently. And ask the question, what does make pain so personal? Hi, I'm your host, Mel Forrest, and welcome back to the third season of the Pain Podcast.
Chronic pain in general in this country is something that is misunderstood and underappreciated in how many layers of complexity it comes with.
It's so unique because it's really complex.
My name is Amar Zaidi, and I'm a pediatric hematologist.
My name is Janelle Letson, and I'm an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Johns Hopkins University.
Dr. Amar Zaidi and Dr. Janelle Letson are experts in their respective medical fields who interact with people that experience pain on a daily basis. They also recognize that pain is personal. But what are some of these contributing factors? Sure, there's a biological component to pain, but does where you live, where you work, or even how people and society perceive you contribute to the experience of pain? To better understand how others experience and feel pain differently, we need to address not just one, but all of the components of the biopsychosocial approach. So in this episode, we talk with Dr. Zaidi and Dr. Letson about not just the biological and psychological factors, but also the social side of pain.
It comes with, of course, biological components, but it also comes with psychosocial components. The accumulation of those three experiences, the psychologic, the sociologic, and the biologic, at that intersection is where pain manifests. And until you're addressing all three of them, you're not really dealing with the pain properly.
It is likely that in the pursuit of understanding, a person can travel down even just one of these roads and receive answers. But as Dr. Zaidi states, it is at the intersection of all three where pain manifests. And until we meet there, we may never have a full understanding of a person's pain. In navigating my own pain journey, I learned a lot about the biological and psychological components that make up pain, but I was still curious to learn more. Pain can affect the way that we live, but can the life we live affect the way that we feel pain? Are there variances in the experience of pain along the lines of culture, race, and ethnicity, to name just a few? To answer these questions, we had to travel down a different road and explore the sociologic components of pain.
It's so unique because it's really complex. So it's this interplay of biological factors, psychological factors, and social factors. So in terms of biology, it's things like our genes, our brain chemicals, our hormones. In terms of psychological factors, it's things like how we think about our pain. So maybe worrying about pain never going away, also sort of aspects about our mood and how that might change over the course of the day. And then when we think about race and culture and ethnicity, those fall into sort of the social factors category. And with culture, we can think about the way that our cultural values might shape how we express pain or cope with pain. Things like race and ethnicity are more of how people perceive us and leads to how we get treated by people. And so it's important to think about this overarching shared experience that people might experience because of these identity factors. But at the end of the day, it's also really important to think about that individual person. Taking this combination, it one, gets us away from potentially stereotyping, but then two, helps us to understand and appreciate what are maybe systematic factors that certain groups of people experience based on their identity that leads to the expression and coping with pain.
A systemic factor is a factor or problem inherent in an overall system, rather than due to a specific individual or isolated factor. If we take a deeper look at systemic factors that affect certain groups of people, might we also find pain disparities based on a person's identity?
We talk about barriers to care. We talk about barriers to accessing care. We talk about racial health disparities. Well, one of the key driving points in racial health disparities is the discrepancy in effective communication between physicians and those populations that may be stereotyped. Whether it's people of color, whether it's people of ability, whether it's the LGBTQ+ community, it doesn't matter, right? The bottom line is that same breakdown in communication, and what we found time and time again is that bias plays out in an interesting way when we look at clinical communication. When we look at something called talk time, which is how much time the physician spends talking in a physician-patient encounter, we note that physicians who have implicit biases end up spending more time talking and less time listening in rooms where those biases may be coming into play.
Implicit bias, as defined by Webster's Dictionary, is bias or prejudice that is present but is not consciously held or recognized. Dr. Letson expands upon pain disparities based on race and ethnicity.
We do see disparities based on race and ethnicity, based on gender, based on age. Thinking about race and ethnicity, the biggest disparities that we see are when we compare Black and non-Hispanic white individuals in terms of access to pain care and then also how well pain is managed. And so what we tend to see in general is that compared to non-Hispanic white people, Black people are more likely to be treated by their providers as being drug-seeking. And so this results in, rather than getting referrals to specialty clinics, getting referrals to sort of drug treatment centers, a lower likelihood of being prescribed opioids, and then also higher rates of getting screened for drug use. And so these are systematic differences in the way that people tend to be treated in healthcare systems, but it also kind of in this healthcare setting can apply also more broadly to sort of structures in our society. And so when we think about the impact of structural racism on access to care, we see that neighborhoods that have a higher proportion of Black and Latina people, the pharmacies in those areas will tend to not carry the prescription medications that people need for their pain or that they're prescribed for their pain. There tend to be lower density of pain specialty clinics or pain specialty services like acupuncture or physical therapy. And so it's both kind of within the healthcare system that we see differences in how people are treated, but then also more broadly from these systems and structures that are in place that we see differences in access to care.
Discussing implicit bias and the systemic factors that lead to the health and pain disparities a person may experience based on their identity is important, but it's also a reality for far too many people. When we return, Dr. Zaidi gives us a look into what it can be like for a patient with sickle cell disease to visit the emergency room for pain. But first, a brief word about our sponsor.
My name is Patrick James Lynch. I'm one of the producers of the Pain Podcast, and I have severe hemophilia A. Chronic pain can be caused by many things, but if you're like me and have hemophilia, chances are some of your pain might be the result of what's called hemophilic arthropathy, or HA for short. Tremo was founded with the goal of developing and delivering non-opioid pain therapies for people living with pain. Tremo's Reset HA study is a clinical research study for people who experience joint pain due to hemophilia. The study is evaluating an oral, non-opioid investigational drug designed to be taken once a day to see if it may potentially help relieve joint pain and improve physical function in people with hemophilic arthropathy, or HA. You may be eligible to participate in this clinical research study if you are between the ages of 12 and 75, have been diagnosed with hemophilia A or B, have chronic pain in one or more joints, and do not take opioid medication more than 4 days a week. If you are interested in learning more about taking part in Tremo's Reset HA study, visit resethastudy.com. That's resethastudy.com to find a study location near you. Reset the way you manage your pain. Visit resethastudy.com today.
In serial measurements of quality of life, it's worse to have sickle cell disease than to be actively getting chemotherapy for an active malignancy.
In sickle cell disease, pain develops when sickle-shaped red blood cells block blood flow through blood vessels to the arms, legs, joints, chest, and abdomen. This pain can come on suddenly, last a few hours to a few days, and is often described as throbbing, sharp, or even stabbing. Knowing the pain that comes with sickle cell disease, Dr. Zaidi gives us a look into what it can be like for a patient with sickle cell disease to visit the emergency room for a sickle cell crisis.
So if we look at national trends, let's just look at national trends. So the first thing is, the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute in 2014 published a consensus guideline and said sickle cell patients, when they hit the emergency room, should be triaged at the second highest level possible and should get their pain medicine within 60 minutes of their arrival. Our colleagues at Duke, Paula Tanabe and her team, looked exactly at that. How long does it take for sickle cell patients to get their first opioid infusion? And what they find, we're seeing patients waiting 2, 4, 6, 9, even up to 10, 11 hours in the state of North Carolina where they were studied. On top of that, we look at someone like Carlton Haywood, who's a sickle cell doctor at Emory, and we see that looking at national databases, on average, sickle cell patients wait 25% longer than everybody else in emergency rooms. This problem is not accidental, right? This is something that is built into the system. It's programmed into physicians. So sickle cell patients feel this no matter where they go.
Earlier, we discussed how implicit bias can affect the way physicians treat pain. But how do we even begin to address this issue? Well, the answer isn't quite so simple, but maybe finding the causes of the cause could be a good start.
Let's talk about 1851, and let's talk about Samuel Cartwright, a slave physician who would examine slaves at the time and say they have a condition called dysesthesia aethiopica. And what this condition meant is that their skin was thicker than everyone else. And that thickness of their skin would cause them to act differently, cause trouble, and the way to get around this was to beat them frequently and stimulate that skin. That's 1851. Certainly you would say, Dr. Z, we're in 2021, right? Things must be different. This can't be obviously what's being taught right now, and it's not, right? But in 2017, a survey done of the general population of medical students and medical residents shows that about a quarter of medical trainees still think that white skin is not as thick as black skin, and that black skin is less sensitive than white skin. So even though this is not being taught actively, it has built a cage around our ability to truly go beyond what's been pushed into the system and how we're taught and educated.
There was a 2016 study that looked at medical trainees' perceptions and beliefs around where differences between black and white adults, how they experience pain. And what they identified was that among trainees, there was actually a pretty high prevalence of misbeliefs. These trainees thought that patients who they would see who are black, they would have lower pain sensitivity due to differences in nerve endings. And so that kind of misbelief would result in people being less likely to prescribe opioids or other kinds of pain treatments.
So you can imagine then the experience for most sickle cell patients echoes exactly what we've talked about. It is filled with disbelief, lack of trust. What you end up with is patients who are choosing between death and dignity. Do they go to the emergency room and not be believed they're in pain, or do they just stay home and suffer?
Throughout the season, we will continue to discuss systemic factors that affect a person's access to care and dive deeper into the various mechanisms that contribute to pain disparities. But to close out my conversation with Dr. Z and Dr. Letson, I was curious to know if they were hopeful that someday there might be a clearer path towards understanding, a path where we can finally meet at that intersection where pain manifests and truly understand what makes pain so personal.
I do think this reshifting and framing of the way the field thinks about pain is an important one to eliminate disparities. So if we're shifting away from thinking that these differences come out of just differences in biology, and we're starting to understand that there are social causes that can influence physiological processes, but that really the root is from this sort of social aspect that is something that we can intervene on, then I think that will, one, shift the way that healthcare providers are sort of conceptualizing where pain comes from and why pain might differ for people, and then two, think about what kinds of treatments we're targeting. So it's not about targeting necessarily the biology, but targeting the social systems and social processes that impact biology differently.
Hope is an important thing to hold on to, right? Without that, what are we doing? There's a sickle cell warrior named Hertz Nazaire. He's a legendary sickle cell warrior and advocate. He's a painter. One of his paintings is called 10 Redefined. It's a picture of a face with tears running down it and normal red blood cells sort of all around the face. He painted this several years ago after a bad experience in an emergency room. And the concept of 10 redefined is fascinating when you hear it from Hertz. He says, what 10 for me is today might not be what 10 is for me tomorrow. 10 is changing. Today, the worst pain you have could be the pain of stubbing your toe. Tomorrow, you could get hit by a truck. The pain's going to be different, right? So that 10 is it's a moving goalpost that you just can't define something that's so dynamic in not only its characteristics, but also in its intensity. The approach then of you're in pain and I trust and believe that you're in pain is something that patients don't necessarily see all the time. But when they do, it becomes clear that their clinical course changes. Chronic pain in general in this country is something that is misunderstood and underappreciated in how many layers of complexity it comes with. By the time this conversation will be done, there will have been 20 new sickle cell disease patients born in the world. There's a child born with sickle cell disease every 2 minutes worldwide. This mutation has been around for a long time. Mutation's not going to change, but certainly physicians' perspectives, the system's perspectives are malleable, and I'm hopeful will change.
Perspectives, biases, systems. These are just some of the contributing social factors that can have an effect on the way a person experiences, feels, and manages pain. And if we're not addressing these social aspects, then are we really understanding pain? What makes pain so personal is the sum total of its parts: the biological, psychological, and the sociological. Like Dr. Z said, it's at this intersection of all three where pain manifests. And until we meet there, we may never have a full understanding of a person's pain. So, I invite you to come along with me for the ride, where we can finally meet at that intersection.
One of the biggest things I hear parents say to me sometimes is, you know, I wish I had really understood or believed my child earlier that this was pain they couldn't overcome.
We discuss pediatric pain and the caretaker experience on episode 2 of The Pain Pod. The Pain Podcast is written and hosted by me, Mel Forrest, produced by Greg Holdsman, edited by Colby Crow, artwork by Ryan Geelan and Christina Newhard, post-production support from Joshua Sterling Bragg, Rob Bradford, Allison Stoney, and Avra Friedman, and executive produced by Patrick James Lynch. The Pain Pod is produced by Bloodstream Media and presented by Tremo Pharmaceuticals. Tremo's Reset HA study is a clinical research study for people who experience joint pain due to hemophilia, and you can learn more about it by visiting resethastudy.com. And as always, if you liked this episode, make sure to subscribe, rate, and share The Pain Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Mel Forrest, and we'll be back next time with episode 2 of The Pain Pod.